mid-November to about mid-March, we were in Goldilocks. And over the past kind of 4 weeks or so, we've kind of been battling between Goldilocks and reflation. Reflation, I want to say a couple of weeks ago, overtook Goldilocks as the dominant regime. And so
Okay,
that
so the baton has been passed from Goldilocks to reflation.
exactly. And eventually we expect the baton to be passed from reflation to inflation. That's a risk-off regime. We don't know that we're there yet, but we are concerned that instead, we thought that the risk-on regime, the condition of markets would last, persist into the third quarter. However, there's some fundamental changes in our research that suggest that we might have to pull that forward.
Welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm its founder and your host, Adam Taggart. When I last interviewed today's guest back in late December, he said that the forecast generated by his proprietary model made him about as bullish as he'd ever been on stocks heading into 2024. And to give credit where credit's due, his positioning was spot on the money. The S&P and NASDAQ both zoomed higher by 11% in Q1. So, what's his model telling us to expect in Q2? To find out, we'll ask the man himself. Today, we've got the good fortune of speaking with Darius Dale, founder and CEO of 42 Macro. Darius, thanks so much for joining us today.
Adam, it's such a pleasure to be here, my friend. Thank you for having me, and thank you for the kind introduction, my friend. Appreciate you.
You're very welcome. It is well-earned, as I said. And not only was your Q1 prediction spot on the money, like I said, but that was coming off of a high of a lot of really good predictions across 2023. So you're kind of on a big roll here. And it, understandably, a lot of people have been asking me since your last appearance, hey, get Darius back on. We want to see what he sees coming up for Q2. So here we are. We're a couple of weeks into the start of Q2. Maybe a little bit of a rockier start to the quarter than the fun ride that we had in Q1. Are you still as bullish as you were, or what's your model telling you for Q2?
Yeah, great question, man. So we are still quite bullish, particularly on the risk assets. We are in a reflation market regime. Reflation is a risk on regime in which you generally get rewarded for taking more risk and shunning things like treasury bonds, more defensive type exposures in lieu of cyclicals and commodities and high beta risk assets, things like crypto and stocks. So we continue to pound the table on that. There's some things that have changed at the margin from a fundamental standpoint, which we'll obviously unpack today, that are giving us less confidence in the sustainability of the reflation regime. But at least from the perspective of the themes that are driving asset markets, there's quite a few themes that have yet to kind of go by the wayside that would ultimately, when they go by the wayside, we'll no longer be in a risk on market regime. But until they do, we think there's some more upside.
Okay. All right. Well, I know that you have a probably one of the most detailed proprietary models out there. You have a massive parade of charts and indicators that you like to show. I've given you the ability to share your screen here. Maybe the best thing to do is just start diving in. And I know you've got a dashboard that you start with that kind of tells you, gives you sort of a summary of all the things you look at. Maybe we want to start there, but if you want to start somewhere else, please let me know. As you're pulling that up, let me just quickly remind folks that for all things Thoughtful Money, it's including our newsletter, our recent content, our free consultations that you can sign up for. Head over to thoughtfulmoney.com. Everything you need is there. All right, Darius. So for the main event here, I've got a lot of sort of general fundamental questions for you about where things are headed. But why don't we start with the indicators that you're watching most closely right now? Do you want to pull up your dashboard here?
Absolutely. Let's do that. So I'm pulling up our a refresh version of our monthly macro scouting report. April was our most recent monthly macro scouting report. Before we even get into those particular indicators, let's walk investors through the 42 Macro risk management process. We do things very differently than the average investor does here at 42 Macro, and we're very proud of that. The reason we're proud of that is because the average investor just typically does not have good investment results. You got to be doing things differently if you want to have different results than the average investor. So in terms of how we think about keeping our clients on the right side of market risk, i.e. long the right assets, that long the assets that are going up and short and or out of the assets that are going down, it's really a three-step process. The first step of that process, which you're alluding to and we were discussing, is positioning for identifying and positioning for the market regime, particularly when the market regime changes. You know, it's getting into the trade when you need to get into the trade to actually give yourself an opportunity to maximize upside capture. So we use our global macro risk matrix, which we'll unpack shortly, in terms of helping investors identify what the market regime is and how that's evolving over time. And then we help investors prepare for regime change using a combination of quantitative signals, vis-a-vis our macro weather model, which we'll touch on, and then vis-a-vis our qualitative signals, which are the fundamental themes that are ultimately driving asset markets and creating the risk-on reflation market regime. And so, as I mentioned earlier, when you're in a reflation regime, reflation is a risk-on regime. You know, in terms of the factor bets you generally want to make, you want to be long risk assets, short defensive assets. You want to be long high beta, short low beta. You want to be long cyclical, short defensives. You want to be long growth, short value. You want to be long small and mid cap, short large caps. You would typically want to be long international, short US. You want to be long EM, short DM. You want to be long spread products in the fixed income markets, short treasuries. If you're going to be in the treasury market, you want to be short rates. They typically outperform the belly, which typically outperforms long rates, which typically, these all have negative absolute returns, by the way. And credit, you want to be in high yield credit over investment grade. And with respect to commodities, industrial commodities tend to outperform energy commodities, which tend to outperform ag commodities, but they all have positive absolute returns. And then lastly, foreign currencies tend to outperform the US dollar, although that's obviously not the case in this current inflation regime. So let's get into our global macro risk matrix, which again, we use to help investors position for the market regime. That global macro risk matrix is a systematic quantitative tool that we built here at 42 Macro that leverages two elements of our research. One, our volatility adjusted momentum signal. That's one of our key indicators that we use to help identify momentum and inflection in asset markets. And then we use our grid asset market back test to understand how asset markets have historically behaved so we can relate the current volatility adjusted momentum signals relative to what they're trying to price in from a regime perspective. And so there are 42 markets in this model. And we're, as I mentioned, we're scoring them again through the lens of our volatility adjusted momentum signal. The green check marks indicate that the asset has a bullish VAMS indicator condition. The orange check marks means it's neutral, which just means volatility is not confirming the direction of price, depending on no matter what direction it's in. And then in terms of the red, that just means both price and volatility are confirming negative momentum in the asset. So for example here, let's pick on the S&P 500. The S&P 500 is currently bullish from the perspective of its volatility adjusted momentum signal. Historically, the S&P 500 has had positive absolute returns and has had bullish VAMS indications in both Goldilocks and reflations. So the model was giving both Goldilocks and reflation a point. We're doing that same process daily across this table. And ultimately, what we're trying to do to identify the market regime is identify which regime is getting the most love from those 42 markets in the table. It's organized by equities, volatility, commodities, currencies, and then fixed income. We got rate spreads, and other indicators as well in terms of that. And so right now, reflation has 25 of those 42 markets confirming it. That's the highest share, 41%. So we say reflation is the market regime. It's the regime that has the highest share in terms of the strength of signal in the 62nd percentile. So it's not yet peaked from a perspective of a reflation regime. You typically want to get nervous about regime change once you get into the kind of upper decile there. So we have some room to go in terms of this reflation market regime. And so that's step one, identify the regime, position for the regime based on what we know the historical factor dispersion has been. And step two is-
Okay, sorry to interrupt, but just, so we're in reflation, and maybe should I say we're still in reflation, meaning Q1 was a reflation regime, correct?
Q1 was mostly Goldilocks.
Mostly Goldilocks, okay.
Mid-November to about mid-March, we were in Goldilocks. And over the past kind of 4 weeks or so, we've kind of been battling between Goldilocks and reflation. Reflation, I want to say a couple of weeks ago, overtook Goldilocks as the dominant regime. And so—
Okay, so the baton has been passed from Goldilocks to reflation.
Exactly. And eventually we expect the baton to be passed from reflation to inflation. That's a risk-off regime. We don't know that we're there yet, but we are concerned that instead, we thought that the risk-on regime, the condition of markets would last, persist into the third quarter. However, there's some fundamental changes in our research that suggested that we might have to pull that forward. So we'll talk about the fundamental side after this. So that's step one. Step one is identify the regime, position for the regime based on the historical dispersion across factors within the regime. Step two is help investors prepare for regime change using quantitative signals. And step three, again, is the qualitative signals, which we'll talk about shortly. But on the quantitative signaling side, we use our macro weather model. So this is another proprietary tool that we built here for our clients here at 42 Macro that's sequencing the momentum and or extreme values in these principal components of macro that and each of those features corresponds or at least has historically produced a set of excess return dispersion for each of these asset classes. And so each signal is contributing independently to the excess return dispersion back test for each of these asset markets. And then we aggregate it across all 20 signals to determine is an asset market likely to behave like it historically has from a return perspective? Should it expect better than normal returns as Bitcoin does currently on a rolling 3-month outlook basis? Or should it expect kind of more baseline type returns in the asset? And that's what we're seeing for the stock market, bond market, US dollar and commodities. And so when you aggregate all those signals up, you know, the stock market saying, okay, we're, you know, pretty normal time conditions for the stock market, which is obviously generally appreciating. I want to say on a rolling 3-month basis, the compounded return for the S&P is somewhere around 3%. So that's obviously positive. Bond market's a neutral signal and Bitcoin's a bullish signal. In our opinion, those signals in totality suggest that the current risk on market regime, which is currently reflation, could be Goldilocks to reflation, that risk on market regime has a, you know, reasonable probability, like a middling probability of surviving over the next 3 months based on the constellation of each of these outlooks. And so that's, so we say, okay, that's the quantitative signaling aspect of it. We think we can survive in a risk on regime over the next 3 months based on what the current constellations of the principal components of macro are signaling. And then we layer on our fundamental research, which are things like, where are we going to be from a growth standpoint? Where are we going to be from a policy standpoint? Where are we going to be from an inflation standpoint? And how is the positioning cycle behaving? That can give us a little bit more color onto, okay, if we can get past 3 months in terms of a look window, then you know that'll obviously allow us to take bigger positions, make higher conviction bets in our portfolio across those factors.
Okay, great. Go back to that screen here. So again, I just want to remind folks that your model basically focuses on the coming 3 months, right?
This model.
This model. Yeah. So you think about it like a car that's got headlights, and you feel confident about what you can see in your headlights. The further out you go, you're less confident about what lies ahead in the road. Your model is somewhat similar, where it's saying, "Hey, we feel like we get a pretty good view in the next 3 months." But after that, it gets squirrelier. So let's just focus on what we have confidence in. You're nodding as I'm saying this. Okay, so I just, if I remember correctly, when we were looking at this exact same slide 3 months ago or 4 months ago at the beginning of January, almost everything was green there. Yeah, commodities might have been the one that was a yellow light. But now we have Bitcoin that's still green. Everything else is yellow. What I hear you saying is the model is saying, hey, you know, we feel like risk on is still likely to continue in the next 3 months. So this isn't cause for concern that the colors are changing necessarily, but it's just maybe showing that would you say the degree of bullishness is moderating a little bit?
100%, and that's what you should expect in any market cycle, right? As the markets move to price in economic developments, and then economic developments are reflectively impacted by market prices, and I think we're seeing evidence of that with inflation currently. So, for example, inflation, in our opinion, it went from trending lower, which is contributing positive excess returns for things like stocks, bonds, and Bitcoin, to negative excess returns to trending higher, contributing negative excess returns. Another feature that changed in terms of inflecting those signals from bullish to neutral as they are now, in terms of what we talked about when we were here in late December, early January, the sovereign fiscal balance as a percent of GDP inflected from a negative trend to a positive trend. So that negative trend, i.e. the budget deficit was getting bigger, was contributing positive excess return with respect to the baseline back test for most risk assets. Now it's contributing negative excess return. So we had a couple big things change at the margins that are ultimately contributing to the downgrade in those composite signals in terms of the stock market, bond market, and I want to say the commodities signals as well. And so it's less bullish, but it's not bearish yet is the kind of the key takeaway. So when we think about this, you know, we were on the program in late December, early January, we were saying, hey, all of our models are max bullish. The global macro risk matrix, the market regime was in Goldilocks, which is the most bullish regime. The macro weather model was saying we had a high probability of sustaining that risk on condition in terms of market regime for at least the next 3 months. That's obviously come to fruition. And then our fundamental research, when you piece together the puzzle on growth, inflation, policy, and positioning, that was all signaling this thing had legs as well. The fundamental research is less bullish as well, in so much that the macro weather model is less bullish as well. So we can unpack some of those dynamics as we progress through the conversation.
Okay, great. So here we have, so we know what regime we're in. Here we have basically the dashboard, sort of telling us what to expect for the next 3 months. I want to get to your fundamental, like what you're seeing on the fundamental sides of things in just a second. I want to clarify one thing about when you were on the program last, because you're right, you were saying late December, early January. We recorded it, now that I remember, in late December. And of course, we had the winter holidays, and the video didn't launch until early January. So that's why I was sort of remembering early January. But you're right. When we actually talked, it was the very, very end of Q4. So, all right, here we are now in April. We've got this different regime that the torch has been passed. You've got the advice that this dashboard here is telling you about what to look for. Now, on the fundamental side of things, what is happening right now on the more macro side, policy side, et cetera, that you are watching most closely that you think might change the game going forward?
100%, 100%. So yeah, so let me before I answer that, let me just kind of summarize this one more time in terms of our investment process. It's, I love your car, the headlights analogy, because I liken to think of it as you're sort of as an investor. We're kind of walking around in a dark room that is the uncertain global economy. That's the uncertain policy, and the future is always uncertain. It's varying degrees of uncertain, but it's always uncertain. And so what we try to do with for our investors here is shine as bright a light as a flashlight as we possibly can for them on a daily basis. We refresh all these models 6 days a week for our clients at 42 Macro. So transitioning to the fundamental side of the discussion, in terms of trying to extend the kind of the distance we can see into the future, or the kind of conviction we can build in the sustainability of a regime, or more importantly, start to build conviction in a regime phase transition, which is something why I suspect we're going to be coaching investors through in the coming months. And so, in terms of the themes that are currently impacting asset markets, from a modal outcome perspective, our resilient U.S. economy theme, which we authored in the summer of 2022, persists. All the data continues to support the resiliency of the economy. The immaculate disinflation narrative, in my opinion, died this week, and got replaced by our sticky inflation theme. This is something we saw building. I think you and I talked about our HOPE plus I framework, which I got from watching Michael Kantrowitz on your show.
Kantrowitz, yep.
Yeah,
Kantrowitz.
exactly. So that framework, the key takeaway from that framework, which we'll talk about shortly, was that inflation was probably going to bottom at a level that's inconsistent with 2% inflation. And so we knew that at some point, immaculate disinflation was going to run out. I would argue that after the data we saw this week, we finally got official confirmation from both leading and lagging indicators that immaculate disinflation is probably dead. It's not to say inflation won't trend lower, but the concept of we're going to just go back to 2% without, with rainbows and puppy dogs and above trend nominal GDP growth, in our opinion, is kind of foolish. And I think a lot of investors realize it's foolish. And that's why you're seeing a bloodbath in the bond market. That's why you're seeing a pullback in risk assets this week and really over the last few weeks, because I think markets are kind of front running that. In terms of what's been causing a lot of positivity, not just in US equities and US credit and crypto, but broader global equities and cyclicals and commodities are right tail risk themes, particularly China, the green shoots globally. We authored the view in January that the global economy was really going to start to show strength, certainly on both a delta basis, but also relative to consensus expectations, which were quite muted for most of the major economies in the world. And right now, we're in a period where all the major economies in the world have leading indicators that are trending higher, with significantly positive, where most of them have significantly positive economic surprise index values, which basically means everything we said came true from that perspective. And then lastly, Jay and Janet, one of the reasons why I think the advent of sticky inflation has not yet caused a market regime phase transition from a risk-on regime, currently reflation, to a risk-off regime, which I suspect inflation would be next. The reason I think it has not cause that phase transition is because of our other theme, which is Jay and Janet want a soft landing. And so that's the key takeaway there, is that as long as forward guidance out of the Fed and net financing policy out of the Treasury remain supportive for asset markets, it's good, you're gonna have a hard time being a bear. Eventually, we suspect that the sticky inflation theme will cause enough problems from a reported data perspective to cause them to pivot. But again, we don't expect that pivot to come anytime soon. If anything, we learned from Jay Powell last month that more time over time, as he keeps stressing over time, they might be very comfortable with a very bumpy and uneven path back to 2% inflation. So in our opinion, this is a Fed that is acquiescing to fiscal dominance. We talked about fiscal dominance last time we were on. And in our opinion, that acquiescing to fiscal dominance effectively means that they're going to allow above trend nominal GDP growth to persist for a while, which obviously is structurally bullish for risk assets and is structurally bearish for treasury bonds. So we can unpack any of these themes as you want.
Sure. Let's unpack all of them. So first off, Jay and Janet want a soft landing. How much of that, if any, in your mind, is tied to the election?
The Janet side, probably a little bit. I mean, you know, I don't want to get too political here because it's not what we do at 42 Macro. We're quantitative macro risk management, providers. But in terms of just thinking about this from a behavioral standpoint, Janet Yellen is a her boss is Joe Biden. Obviously, he's up for re-election. Joe Biden is the guy who made her the first female Treasury Secretary in U.S. history. So I assume she owes him a debt of gratitude for that. Janet Yellen is known to be a staunch liberal Democrat. Obviously, she's you know it's in her best interest from a political standpoint to support Biden's re-election nomination. She's a woman, obviously, with a lot what's going on with abortion in this country, she probably is going to be on the wrong side of Trump on that as well. And then lastly, you know, which I think is an underrated thing, Trump is he's proven himself to be quite disrespectful of you know women in power, and I think Janet Yellen probably would take offense to that if she told you behind closed doors. So you know, so let's unpack some of the dynamics that I think have really contributed to. Her contributing to positive liquidity dynamics. You know, we have U.S. liquidity trending higher, as we indicated in our macro weather model. Let me just jump back to that real quick before we go into there. So one of the financial kind of in terms of the financial economy cycles that contribute to the macro weather model, we have our net liquidity model, which it's everyone's net liquidity model now. Fed balance sheet minus the Treasury TGA and RRP. That's trending higher alongside our global liquidity proxy, which is a global central bank. Sorry, global all this aggregated sum of the central bank balance sheets from all the major economies in the world. Their broad money supply and their FX reserves minus gold. So, getting into Yellen's contributions from a positive liquidity standpoint, you know, she's her net financing policy over the past, you know, really year or so has caused the RRP balance to decline substantially. It's basically gone from over $2 trillion to about $450 billion currently, in our opinion. And so the reason that's happened is because she's been flooding the market with bills and creating an alternative a store of value for money market fund exposure. And so in our opinion, not only was she doing that, she was doing that at the context of the Fed guiding to rate cuts. So in our opinion, the double whammy of guiding to rate cuts and flooding the market with bills created an exodus out of the Fed's reverse repo facility balance, which obviously is a positive feature for global liquidity for U.S. liquidity. So if you look at this on a trailing 12-month basis, Adam, the share of a net marketable borrowing that was in the bill market is 69%. There's so if you kind of break open the net marketable bar the net mark the marketable U.S. marketable Treasury securities outstanding bills are roughly 23% of that. And so the fact that she's flooded the market with 69% bills over the past year or so tells you that you know this has been a very explicit policy to fund the government with the funds that were trapped in the RRP. And so that's been very positive and very supportive. We suspect you know she's pulling back on bills here in Q2, but in our opinion, we don't expect we investors should not expect that to be persistent. We expect her to get back into the bill market at least in Q3 to further try to push this RRP balance to zero. I suspect it probably is going to go to zero shortly before the election because that's kind of where it's been for most of its life. You know, only in the last few years did we have significantly positive balances in the RRP. So that's the Janet Yellen side of the Jay and Janet want a soft landing theme. The Jay Powell side of the Jay Janet Yellen want a soft landing theme is the Fed sticking its fingers in its ear, hands over its eyes, and saying, "We're gonna cut rates. We're gonna cut rates." They're guiding to three rate cuts in 2024, another three rate cuts in 2025, and another three rate cuts in 2026. And the reason they're doing that is because obviously, if you look at their longer term projections for the funds rate, you know they think neutral is somewhere around 256 basis points on a median basis in terms of the participants, and real somewhere around 56 basis points. In our opinion, those numbers are way too low. They're going to go up over time. This is something we've been arguing since the summer of 2022 when we altered that resilient U.S. economy theme. Is that neutral is probably going to be much higher, and so we're just now starting to have those discussions as investors. The bond market is obviously having that discussion right now, and it's certainly not winning. But in our opinion, the resiliency of the economy does not warrant rate cuts. The U.S. economy is continuing to prove very resilient across a variety of metrics: income, consumption, labor markets. In our opinion, so the fact that the Fed is even talking about rate cuts right now has been a very positive boon to asset markets because we've seen that priced into four rate curves. If you look at the December 2024 Fed funds rate, That's currently pricing in about 50 basis points of easing. If you look at that, another 50 basis points in 2025 and another 25 basis points in 2026. So not on par with the Fed's aggressive projections, but certainly pricing in rate cuts, which from a financial conditions perspective have already flowed into the economy and creating positive outcomes.
All right, so let me ask you this real quick on rate cuts, unexpected rate cuts. That's what Powell has been guiding to. Although in recent week or so, we've had some Fed, executives out there sort of raising the question of like, well, maybe we won't do three. Bostic, I think, just said maybe only one, and maybe in Q4, right? But my main question is at the start of the quarter, it's the start of Q1, sorry, the start of Q1. I think the market was expecting what? Something like seven rate cuts this year. And basically, Powell said, no, we're sticking with three, and the market had to blink and it had to march them all the way down to three. I think the average market expectation right now is for a little less than three, at least the last numbers I saw. But it didn't matter. Like, the stocks powered higher the whole quarter. So my question is, you're saying that rate cuts are priced into the market, and I believe they are, but fewer rate cuts are priced into the market than there were, 40 days ago, or sorry, 3 months ago, 3.5 months ago. And yet that diminishment in rate cuts didn't stop the market from powering higher. So I guess my question is, do rate cut expectations really matter?
Yeah, they matter because they're priced into the forward rate curve right now. We're getting less rate cuts priced out. We're getting rate cuts priced out. We're not getting rate hikes priced in. And so the fact that the forward rate curve is as low as it is has allowed our financial conditions to be artificially higher than they probably should be at this stage of the economic cycle, with nominal GDP running well above trend, in our opinion. And so in terms of the pricing out of rate cuts, again, the forward rate curve is still lower from today. And so that the delta negative aspect of that has flowed into financial conditions. Now, obviously, it's caused problems over the past, let's call it 6 weeks, for the bond market. But in our opinion, the reason asset markets have been able to sustain the positive bull runs, and particularly in risk assets, stocks, credit, commodities, crypto, it is our opinion, is because both the U.S. and global economy are proving resilient. So part and parcel with our green shoots globally thing is measuring and mapping all the relevant economic data across all the major economies, which we do. We refresh this table 6 days a week here with our clients at 42 Macro. And if you look at the growth elements of this, every major economy in the world has a composite PMI reading that's trending higher. I mentioned on one hand the number of people that can make a statement like that, but we can make a statement like that every 6 days a week as we refresh the model. And so just isolating the U.S., obviously our composite PMIs trending higher. And if you look at our economic surprise index value at 41, that number is meaningfully elevated relative to its longer term trend. So it's telling you that U.S. growth from a leading indicator perspective is trending higher, and you have positive economic surprises. And those pod that that combination is bullish. It doesn't matter rate the con again. The economy does not require rate cuts. The Fed was just throwing kerosene on the fire anyway. Now they're dumping less kerosene on the fire by pricing out rate cuts and/or delaying the start of the easing cycle. But again, they're still putting kerosene on the fire because they have guided to rate cuts, three rate cuts over the next 2024, 2025, and 2026, respectively. I like to jump ship back to the U.S. economy and kind of unpack some of the things that we're seeing there. So, the U.S. economy is still resilient. If you look at real GDP, we're still compounding at 3.4% Q over Q SAR in the most recent quarter. That number is above trend. Why has the economy been resilient? In our opinion, primarily consumer spending. Consumer spending compounding at 2.7% 3 month annualized. That number is slightly above trend. It's being driven by two factors. One factor, we have personal consumption expenditures, or sorry, real services consumption. That number is growing 5% 3 month annualized. And then we have personal savings rate continues to be well below trend. And the reason the personal savings rate has been well below trend is what we call the West Village Montauk effect. So this is something I learned from my 10 plus years living in Manhattan. I noticed that the people who spend the most money in Manhattan, whether it be on fancy apartments in the West Village, which is one of the nicer neighborhoods there, or spending tens of thousands of dollars on vodka, on Montauk every summer, it's not the people who make the most money. It's the people whose parents made the most money. Typically, the young people whose parents are rich. And the reason I say that is because when you have a large stock of savings, it allows you to spend a higher share of your disposable income into consumption. When you don't need to, i.e., when you don't need to save money, you can spend more of the money that you're making. And so evident, we can see this evidence very clearly in this chart here, where we show household assets, where we take cash. So all these values are indexed to the end of 2019. We show household assets, cash. Cash has grown 135% since the end of 2019. Corporate cash has grown 51% since the end of 2019. A lot of that growth came during 2020 and 2021, when the federal government was dumping trillions of dollars into the economy vis-a-vis tax COVID-related tax breaks, forgivable PPP loans. They extended jobless claims and raised the value on jobless claims. I mean, you're basically getting paid not to work. There's a lot of money that was dumped into the economy that found its way onto the private sector balance sheet vis-a-vis household cash and corporate cash. And you see this in a net worth perspective. Household and corporate net worth are up about 34% respectively since then. And all these values are outpacing inflation. But when you think about this from the perspective of the West Village Montauk effect, after we got all this cash and we grew cash very quickly, the savings rate actually started to go negative. So this is personal savings, the actual nominal dollar amount of personal savings indexed to 2019. And as you can see, personal savings have been negative for much of the past 2.5 years because you don't need to save anymore. And that's the West Village Montauk effect
All
in
right.
economics.
So fascinating, and this is I've had have lots of discussions around sort of this the true status of the U.S. consumer. So I got a couple questions for you here, if we can bang through them. First one is, if I look at the green area above the bottom chart versus the red area below the chart, the red area it seems to be a lot smaller in terms of its total size than the green area, which we use this analogy of the pig going through the python in terms of all the COVID, pandemic stimulus that was shoved into the system.
Oh, yeah.
Would you say that the majority of it is still the majority of the pig is still in the python here? Like, do we still have a ton of cash that's just available and sitting on household balance sheets?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'll say so. Let me give you a few stats. So, obviously, even today, through I want to say the data is through Q4, they're up 135% and 851% respectively. But let me throw some statistics out at you. With respect to the household balance sheet, cash, which again we aggregate in terms of checkable deposits and currency plus money market fund exposure, that number is 8.1 trillion in the most recent quarterly results. 8.1 trillion is up from 3.5 trillion at the end of 2019. So it's
Whoa.
the cash has more than doubled since the end of 2019. That's what we're showing here indexed in that chart. So the
And
$8.1
that's on
trillion.
personal, this is household balance sheets
So
alone.
household balance sheets. On the corporate balance sheet, so that 8.1 trillion now is 5% of total household assets. You have to go back to the early 1950s to see such a high share of liquidity as a ratio to total household assets. And then you go to the corporate side, the corporate balance sheet. The corporate balance sheet, cash is when you again aggregate checkable deposits and currency plus money market fund exposure for the corporate sector. That number is at about $2.9 trillion currently, up from $1.9 trillion in the end of 2019. And so that number is also 5% of total corporate assets, which again, you got to go back to the 1950s to see such a high share of liquidity on the corporate sector balance sheet. So in aggregate, the US private sector balance sheet is as flush with cash as much as it has been, since going back to the 1950s on a ratio basis, and obviously on a nominal basis, we're well beyond new heights.
Okay, so go with me on this. So I want to know how much of this story is median versus mean,
Oh, great
right?
question.
So, getting the West Village Montauk effect, is it basically we've got is most of this cash just is it piled up in the super wealthy households? Which to a certain extent can only spend so much in the regular economy, right? There's only so many Montauk estates you want to have. There's only so many jet skis you can own, right? Because I wonder if the negative savings rate is due to, oh, we don't need to save because we have all this cash, right? Or if we're talking about median, then it's, hey, there's a ton of households that are really struggling. I mean, we've seen we consumer spending's gone up, yeah, but it's also gone up because the price of everything's gone up, right? And we've seen an explosion in revolving credit going up, and that revolving credit's at record rates. And so I'm trying to get a sense here, does the data tell you that the economy is resilient because on average we're better off, or is it resilient because we have, on one end of the barbell, a small number of very rich people who are doing just great, And then we have everybody else who's just kind of hanging on by their fingernails.
Great question. Awesome. So this chart shows the share of U.S. consumer spending by income cohort. And so as you can see here, the lower quintile, which everyone continues to be concerned about, you know, the bottom 20%, they only account for 9% of U.S. consumer spending. If you want to look at the lower third in terms of income cohorts, so like the, you know, this would be the quote unquote low income households that everyone's been concerned about, they're only 15% of total U.S. consumer spending. And so I'm not to say, you know, I obviously grew up, you know, the bottom 0.1% of the income and wealth distribution spectrum. So I very much understand the plight of my fellow people in this, you know, segment of the U.S. economy. But when we're talking about where is the economy headed, we're an afterthought. My people are an afterthought. The people who spend all the money in the economy are the rich people. And so if you look at it, if the upper quintile in terms of income cohorts, it's the top 9th and 10th decile, that's 39%. Of total U.S. consumer spending. So
top 20% is doing 40% of the spending.
100%. The top third spending 51% of the spending. So when we think about where is the U.S. economy headed, it really is about, you know, how many jet skis are being bought in Montauk and how many bottles of Whispering Angel are being consumed at Surf Lodge and, you know, how many bottle services is going to be happening at Sidebar Sunday. You know, that really is the U.S. economy. Now, it's a shame. We can have a long-winded political discussion about whether that's good or not, but it is what it is. And so in terms of trying to understand where the economy and asset markets are headed, you have to look at statistics as they are from an aggregated perspective. And from an aggregated perspective, the U.S. consumer and the U.S. economy continue to hum along.
All right. So what I hear you saying is the top spenders are doing just fine, and therefore no worries right now about the resilience of the U.S. economy at this point in time. There is a whole fairness discussion to be had there. And Darius, I'd actually love to have you back on to really dig into this in depth at some point. But if we could maybe just spend a minute on it, the trajectory of this, right, where from the data that I see, if you see different data, feel free to, you know, tell me how you see it. But from the data I see, it seems that increasing, like the trajectory that we're on as a society is that the wealth is increasingly concentrating, right? More and more wealth is concentrating into fewer and fewer pockets, right? And personally, I don't see a high probability outcome on my dashboard that says that's going to adjust at any point soon, right? That we're going to adopt policies that are going to change that. I can think of all sorts of policies we get to if we get to some sort of societal breaking point. But I kind of have the worry that we're probably going to get to some societal breaking point before that problem is really and truly addressed. That's my opinion. I'm curious to hear your top level thoughts.
Oh, I have to tip my cap to my former colleague and one of my mentors, Neil Howell, and his work with the fourth turning. Neil, I and I would both very much agree with you, Adam, that we are actually heading towards a breaking point. It's not going to be tomorrow or anytime soon. Neil seems to think that the current fourth turning regime that we're in has another about, you know, 8 to 12 years, give or take. You can't be too specific, but you know, so we are on a slow burn path to all hell breaking loose. And typically, what you tend to see in fourth turnings, one of those things is income inequality tends to be relatively strong during fourth turnings. I.e., you tend to have a less distribution of wealth, less distribution of income. It tends to be very concentrated on fourth turnings, and as a function of that, you tend to have a populist outcry from the voting you know cohorts, and they force government officials to implement populist policies. And so you tend to see the sovereign budget deficit blow out during fourth turnings. You tend to see sovereign debt and interest expense rise materially during fourth turnings. These are all things that we did.
Tick, by the way.
Yeah, exactly.
Like you're mentioning the checkboxes that were going.
Yeah, down. Totally. Ooh, and then guess what? Inflation tends to be materially higher than fourth turnings, you know. So we are in a fourth turning. It's looking very much like a fourth turning when you go back and look at hundreds of years of data as we have here in terms of our fourth turning analysis. You know, we'll keep that off limits because that's our clients will be a little bit upset if I gave sure. that away for free. But you know, I can give you some of the key takeaways, which is, you know, a lot of what we're seeing from a political cycle standpoint is part and parcel to what we should be expecting, which is more populism, bigger government in response to more populism, and that's going to feed on itself until it ultimately crumbles. And we fully expect things like dollar devaluation, structurally elevated inflation to deal with the burgeoning sovereign debts and deficits. And ultimately, we're probably going to see a significant amount of financial repression and currency debasement as we progress throughout this decade as a function of this. You know, we're just getting started, Adam.
All right. So Darius, how about this? You open to coming back on some point in time, and we have a discussion that's focused on how to prepare for that type of environment
Absolutely. For
versus the next 3 months that we normally talk about.
sure, for sure. And by the way, I want to be clear. Our fundamental research process take that flashlight and makes it brighter. So instead of, the Wacker weather model gives us that rolling 3 month forward projection for each of those main asset classes, which we can then use to derive an estimate for the sustainability of the current regime, or the risk on or risk off condition of the current regime. But the fundamental research we're doing gives us visibility into the next, let's call it 3 to 12 months, even beyond that, if we were talking about fourth turning dynamics, but isolating, the cyclical side of the economy, we're thinking about where are we going to be 1, 2, 3, 4 quarters from now. And 1, 2, 3, 4 quarters from now, I can see a scenario where over the next 1 to 2 quarters, things are fine. But over the next 3 to 4 quarters, things are not so fine, particularly when you layer on the likely policy pivots that we're probably going to see by the Fed and Treasury.
Okay. It's hard for me to get off this track just because it's so fascinating. I'm sure a lot of viewers are we've got their attention too. Let me just ask this general question, then we'll get back to your more current data here, which is I'll wait for the deep dive discussion we have on this topic to get into the specifics, but I'm assuming, and correct me if you have a different opinion, the status quo playbook that Wall Street and most investors are using right now, I'm going to guess that that's not going to fare very well in the final innings of a fourth turning, right? So in other words, there's probably going to be a lot of wealth destruction, wealth transfer, wealth redistribution, all that stuff that could be coming up. And so to just blithely put your head down and say, well, that's 8 years from now and maybe it won't happen or whatnot. Like I think you would think, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the average investor should be learning and educating about what could be happening in a fourth turning to make sure that they're prepared at some point to transition from business as usual to perhaps business as very unusual.
100%, absolutely, and quite frankly, between outside of Neil, which his work is generally focused on the political cycle and the
In
socioeconomic
demos.
outcomes, that create how the political cycles creates different outcomes from a political geopolitical standpoint. Our work is specifically focused on what does a fourth turning mean for the economy, what does the fourth turning mean for policy, and ultimately, as a function of those two, what does the fourth turning mean for asset markets? So again, at the end of this presentation, there's about a 40-page, 40-slide long empirical study where we quantify various factors in the economy to identify, what's likely to occur in a fourth turning. I'll give you one example of that when we show in inflation. So inflation tends to be relatively strong and spike during fourth turnings. So if you look at the baseline, the median inflation rate during first, second, and third turnings is 1.2%. And when you go with data all the way back to 1800, when you think about where inflation is on a median basis during fourth turnings, it's essentially double
It's
at
almost double, yeah.
almost double. And not only is it double, it tends to spike during fourth turnings. And so I think we're in the early innings of a secular bull market in inflation in a fourth turning. And that has very important implications from a stock, from a portfolio construction standpoint, because we were basically exiting a period where inflation was in the 1 to 2% range over the past 10 to 15 years. And we're talking about inflation potentially persistently above 2 to 3, perhaps even in the 3 to 4, 3 to 5% range. And you're talking about persistently positive correlations between stocks and bonds as a function of that. And so this is one of those kinds of dynamics, fourth turning dynamics that investors need to be aware of if you're talking about putting long-term capital to work. This won't matter at every month, every data, every interval, but what it will matter, when we think about investing, we think about this from two lenses, the cyclical and the secular. The secular for something could be bullish, the secular for something could be bearish, but no matter what, the cycle's still going to cycle. The cycles are still going to cycle. And so we help the clients stay on the right side of cyclical risk in markets so that their portfolios are constantly compounding over time. If you're only focused on the secular and you ignore the cyclical, you're going to make a lot of money and then you're going to lose a lot of money. You're going to make a lot of money, you're going to lose a lot of money. When you combine the two, then you allow yourself to make a lot of money, book gains. Make a lot of money, book gains. And so that's what we're trying to do with our macro risk management process that we talked about on slide 6, is trying to help you identify and stay on the right side of that cyclical risk while keeping and understanding some of these longer term secular dynamics through our qualitative research.
Right. And not saying that this is what you would recommend, but like depending upon how you think the fourth turning may play out from an economic and investing standpoint, when you're booking those gains along the way, as you're talking about, you may want to be taking some of those gains and investing them in assets where your horizon is 8 years out or whatever, right? So in other words, like converting paper gains into hard assets like property or gold or something like that. I'm not saying that those are necessarily assets you think are right for the coming fourth turning, but that might be a way to be playing today's playbook, but also thinking about tomorrow's.
100%. And last time we were on, so we built a portfolio construction process for our clients here at 42 Macro, called our KISS portfolio construction process. And so what that is a 60-30-10 trend following approach that combines stocks, fixed income, and Bitcoin. We use the Bitcoin allocation as a leg up in this fourth turning regime to consistently outperform a 60-40 portfolio. And so this is the back test, the out of sample back test for KISS, and it's been live since January of 2023. And so what we know is that it's consistently outperforming 60-40 on any relevant duration. What we also know is that the average annual return is significantly higher than 60-40, with significantly better drawdown and volatility statistics. KISS has an average annual return in terms of the 60-30-10 stocks, fixed income, Bitcoin portfolio that we use as a trend following approach. So there's sort of, dynamic position sizing is what there's a reason why his historically outperformed and continues to outperform that 60 legacy 60-40 portfolio that a lot of our viewers and watchers are kind of pegged to. So just getting back to the summary statistics, KISS has an average annual return of plus 13%, which compares very favorably to 60-40 portfolio's average annual return of 8%. The max drawdown for KISS is minus 12%, which compares very favorably to the max drawdown of the 60-40 portfolio and the duration of this out-of-sample back test of minus 22%. And oh, by the way, that's the only double-digit drawdown in KISS, that minus 12%. There have been two crashes in the 60-40 portfolio since the beginning of 2018. And then if you wanted to run that 60-30-10 portfolio without the top-down risk management overlay or the bottom-up risk management overlay, which we use to infuse vol targeting and dynamic position sizing into the strategy, which makes it work to protect gains. If you just wanted to run 60-30-10 SPY, ag and Bitcoin, you would have crashed three times on your aggregate portfolio over the last 3 years or over the last kind of 5 or 6 years. So in our opinion, this is a better mousetrap. We have thousands of clients around the world following KISS in terms of KISS's current allocations. We're at a 30% cash. And because that 30% cash that would otherwise be allocated to fixed income, both the top-down and bottom-up risk management overlays are combining to get us out of the fixed income markets, which is something our clients have benefited from this year in terms of not wearing all the downside risk that you're seeing in things like TLT. But we are 100% still exposed of our max exposure to the equity market of 60%. We are still 100% of our max exposure to the Bitcoin asset class of 10%. So max exposed to stocks, max exposed to Bitcoin, no exposure to fixed income, and that fixed income exposure goes into liquidity management. We use USFR as our liquidity management instrument. A lot of folks use Fidelity money market funds, et cetera. But generally speaking, we're yielding about 5% on that instrument. So this is a quite frankly, I think this is one of the better mousetraps that the average retail RIA investor can use to grow their wealth, compound their wealth over time, and ultimately avoid big nasty drawdowns. The name of the game as an investor is to maximize upside capture during bull markets and to minimize downside capture during bear markets. It's not to pretend like you're the smartest hedge fund manager in the world and you want to be super long this and super short that, or I know more about commercial real estate or financial plumbing or flows and dealer gamma positioning and all this other stuff. You need to maximize upside capture in bull markets. You need to minimize downside capture in bear markets. And that's all you should be doing as a retail RIA investor.
Completely agree. And I just want to slow you down here because this is the punchline. I want to make sure everybody understands it and gives the takeaway. One of the things that always impresses me about this part when we get to the discussion, Darius, is that you have so much data, right? And you've walked us through a bunch of it, but I know you've just shown us kind of the tip of the iceberg of everything that you look at and all your various models. But you boil it down to a solution that looks incredibly simple. And that's why you call it the Keep It Simple, Stupid portfolio.
We'll keep it simple and systematic.
Okay, sorry. Keep it simple and system. It's much better than stupid. Yes, keep it simple, systematic. But basically, you bring it down to these four ETFs, basically, that you're in, right? And yet, the performance has been great. And you just showed in the previous chart how it outperforms on all these different timelines. It certainly crushed it in Q1, right? It more than doubled the standard 64 market return, right? And I remember coming into Q1 when we talked last, And I think you had the same allocations across the KISS portfolio, right? Where you had dialed your fixed income down to zero, but you were max equities and max Bitcoin because it was Goldilocks. And sure enough, that was the right thing for Q1. Even though the baton has been handed to the reflation trade, it doesn't seem like it's enough has changed for you to change these allocations at least yet. Am I getting that correctly?
100%. And great. That's a great way to kind of delve into how the process works. So, as I mentioned, there's the top-down risk management overlay and the bottom-up risk management overlay. And what those overlays do is, again, the top-down overlay allows us to anticipate changing volatility regimes for the asset. And then the bottom-up risk management overlay is the overlay that allows us to implement dynamic position sizing, which means we're responding to changing volatility regimes in the asset. So, right now, we are in a reflation market regime, which calls for 60% target allocation for stocks. If we were in a risk-off market, we're in a risk-on market regime, which is currently reflation, which calls for the maximum target allocation of 60%. If the market regime phase transition to a risk-off market regime, which is inflation or deflation in our process, the target allocation would get cut in half to 30%. In terms of the actual exposure, the exposure that you're seeing that our clients are implementing in their portfolios, it's 100% because the SPY ETF is bullish from the perspective of our volatility adjusted momentum signal, it's 100% of that target allocation. So it's a full 60%. If the SPY broke down to neutral, which tells you that the volatility is no longer confirming the upturn in price, then we would cut the position in half and so on and so forth from there. And so that process is being played out in terms of fixed income as well. And so in fixed income, if the regime is inflationary, as we are currently, which is reflation, the target allocation is 15% as opposed to the maximum of 30. And then the actual exposure to the fixed income ETF, the Ag ETF, is 0% because the Ag ETF is bearish from the perspective of volatility adjusted momentum signal. So it's a rules-based process. We're bearish FAMs. We don't want to touch it. We'll touch it when it gets back to neutral, and then we'll touch it more when it gets back to bullish. And then lastly, with respect to Bitcoin, we are in a risk-on market regime, currently reflation. So the target allocation is 10% for Bitcoin. And then the actual exposure to Bitcoin is 100% of that 10% because the Bitcoin is still the BTC ETF and both Bitcoin, the asset itself, are bullish from the perspective of volatility adjusted momentum signal. So we're maintaining this process daily for our clients. Obviously, there's very few trades to make. There's only four ETFs. And so on average, there's about three trades per month in this process. And so we're very proud to get it to partner with our clients and give them a simple solution, right? Not complicated is not always better. Trust me, I'm really good at getting complicated, as you guys can see with our
Yeah, well, and that's what amazes me is you boil this ocean of data, and yet you get to something that is so elegantly simple.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. And then for one final thing I want to highlight. We have clients that are very sophisticated retail investors, and we have clients that are obviously RIA investors, investment advisors. Obviously, we have plenty of institutional clients, buy side, global buy side clients as well, and that's what most of our research is focused on in terms of helping them stay on the right side of factor risk. But in terms of helping our retail and RIA investor friends implement customized versions of KISS, we publish this table daily that allows them to implement the top-down and bottom-up risk management overlays for whatever securities they want to be long. So, for example, say you're an investment advisor, you probably can't just be long SPY, Ag, and Bitcoin, but you can probably be long, three sector ETFs, three factor ETFs. You can be long a few fixed income ETFs. You can probably be long gold. You can probably be long, something like in the commodity space. And so, what we're trying to do here is help them identify the signals that they need. We're publishing 6 times a week the signals that they need to maintain the top-down risk management overlay, which is here, and the bottom-up risk management overlay, which is here, vis-a-vis the top-down, the market regime, and the volatility adjusted momentum signal for each of those assets. So that's something we do when we work with our protocol partners, particularly in our investment advisor space. We help them construct customized versions of KISS if they need help constructing that in terms of which factor should they be long. When we help them identify that here right in the table, as I mentioned, when we talked about earlier in terms of this slide here, we said, okay, what are the key portfolio construction considerations in reflation? We just reiterate that here in this slide. So, all of these materials we're refreshing daily, 6 times a week for our clients so that they
Yeah.
can see the right side of market risk.
And I love this, and I'm not denigrating any of your clients at all, but it's sort of like, okay, so if you want to make it complicated, you can subscribe to this and we'll tell you all the different things you can do across all the other asset classes.
Totally.
But of course, I look at this and I'm like, well, but if you just want to keep it simple and still beat the 60-40 model by 2 times, just stick with keep it simple, stupid.
I mean, you're familiar with our friends in our investment advisor space, right? Like, a lot of times they can't just show performance. they need to show excess returns. They need to show why they were smarter than the market. I think it's a
Right.
fool's effort. I think the reality is if the market's giving you beta, you should take beta. And your client should be happy with beta, and it's more of
Exactly.
a communication issue for a lot of them as well. But and again, some people just might not find that something like Bitcoin is relevant for their portfolio.
Right. Yeah, or they just have, they've got a different proprietary model, but they just want to know from you, okay, well, should I be feeding, consumer discretionary right now into that portfolio, right? I mean, like I said, I'm not denigrating them at all, but I think for the average
Retail investor.
investor, especially the DIY investor, right? Why make it overcomplicated and spend all your time coming up with an incredibly complex portfolio allocation if there's one available that still seems to perform as well as yours does and gives you a lot more time to just hang out on the beach and enjoy life and still get, superior returns.
Keep it simple and systematic. I mean, again, investing is very fun, right? Like one of the best, well, this is the reason so many people, do DIY investing is because it is a lifelong journey of education. Piecing together the puzzle gives you great satisfaction. Predicting the future, and when it comes true, gives you great satisfaction. It's not unlike the NFL draft, which is in a couple of weeks. We want to be right about our predictions and prognostications, and so investing can be fun in that regard. But I want to caution investors from relying too much on prediction to construct portfolios, because the reality is most investors are wrong all of the time. The
Right.
best investors in the world are wrong about half of the time. The best in the world are wrong about half of the time. Ask Jim Simons, ask Ken Griffin, ask Stevie Cohen. When they're right, they're sizing their bets appropriately, and more importantly, they're risk managing their losses appropriately so that they can continue taking swings at the pitch or bites at the apple. They stay in the game to play the game. And that's where I think a lot of retail investors go wrong. And so again, what we're trying to do here at 42 Macro is take the best of what I've learned from my 15 years of travels across Global Wall Street, meeting with, again, a lot of the best, biggest, best, most famous fund managers in the world, writing down things and learning things from and helping them construct models and frameworks and things of that nature. And a lot of the stuff that I've learned from them, you see here in 42 Macro Research. This is the best practices that they're doing over at, major firm A, or this is what they're doing from a risk manager standpoint at major firm Y. And so, when you see our research here at 42 Macro, that it's not just Darius Dale. I'm a very smart guy, obviously. We have thousands of clients around the world following our research. But the reality is, I'm smart enough to have learned from the best. And you look at 42 Macro Research. There are three elements that I think that make us stand apart from your average, kind of macro talking head service. One is regime segmentation, as we've highlighted in this slide here, identifying the regime's positioning for the regime. There's Bayesian inference, i.e., refreshing all these models daily, 6 days a week. And so we can spot critical inflections in real time so that we can do something about that critical inflection in our portfolio with enough time for the market to move and actually help us make money and/or save money. And then lastly, this volatility is leading indicator for price. As I mentioned, the volatility adjusted momentum signal is a core feature of our global macro risk matrix. It's a core feature of our KISS portfolio construction process in terms of the bottom-up risk management overlay. So, there's a lot of high-end institutional learning from my 15 years in Global Wall Street that we're just presenting. We're trying to democratize this for, the average investor so that they can get back to the beach and can get back to spending time with their families and don't need to spend too much time consuming bear porn.
All right. All right. Fair point. So there are a few other questions I want to ask you just to wrap things up, but I normally end with a like, hey, where can everybody find learn more about you and your work and potentially sign up for your service? This is probably the right time to have you let folks know just because we just sort of were talking about the key elements of it. So is 42macro.com the place folks should go? And when they go there, what is it a single service for the retail person? Like of your offerings, which should people be looking at?
Yeah, actually, I think I can just pull it up on screen. Let me type it in. This is the beauty of technology, my friend. We can do this in real time. So let me just go straight to our website. So when you land on our website, obviously there's a lot of information about investors, but just click on this blue research button. It'll take you to our research solutions that we have for investors. So the macro investors is essentially our lead-off morning note. That's our daily note. I would argue that's more for the institutional audience, folks who are making capital allocation decisions on a daily basis, in our opinion. So if you're retail or investors, not saying you shouldn't subscribe to that. You know, we'd love to have you, but you need to be very sophisticated to consume that content. The macro risk managers, where is the around the horn, the key feature of that program is the around the horn weekly presentation that we do. That's where we maintain the KISS portfolio construction process. So any changes you see in that KISS portfolio construction, which again, they're about on average 3 trades per month, those will be maintained in the around the horn. And the macro strategist, that's our macro scouting report. That's a 125 to 150 slide presentation every month. I usually get through the content in about an hour and 15 minutes. What we're trying to do is help investors understand the full distribution of probable economic and market outcomes. And so we understand what the modal outcome is based on the current market regime. And then we help investors prepare for regime change with our right tail risk section and the left tail risk section. And then we do that, in the appendix, we also have that deep dive on forked earnings as well. And then the Macro Strategist Pro just helps investors. It's all three products in one. And so that's our best deal, our best offer as well. And one final thing I'll say is, each of these products gets users access to our 42 macro dashboard. So all the research there is housed in the dashboard. We have short term tactical signaling indicators for anyone that is trading very actively in financial markets. We have an economic calendar, and my favorite thing is interacting with our thousands of subscribers in our community chat. Clients will have questions about our research. They'll have questions about other people's research. Hey, Darius, what do you think about this? So-and-so said that. What does this mean? You're bullish now, but so-and-so said is bearish. You know, why are they right? Why are you wrong? We have those kinds of discussions and debates in our community chat. It's a labor of love for me. So it's a very holistic service. It's very community focused. You know, we have clients who've been with us for years and they become leaders amongst our community. It's been one of the great blessings in my life to kind of watch our community grow.
Great. So in that chat there that goes on during the day, you're participating, folks can ask you questions and whatnot, but it sounds like the community is also tapping its own expertise throughout the day too.
100%. We have very sophisticated high-end institutional portfolio managers, CIOs of some of the major funds that you guys are all aware of that are interacting with retail investors in this community chat, obviously as, the pseudonyms and whatnot. But I can tell the sophistication of an investor by the nature of the questions they're asking, the nature of the answers they're supplying to their other Team 42 community members as well. And so it's a very robust community. It's a very safe space. One of the things, we have one rule in our entire community, both in here and on Twitter or elsewhere, it's be kind. And we don't have any negativity. It's, we've been very blessed in that regard for the past few years. And so I think it's a very safe space for learning. It's an awesome space for learning. And obviously our published research, you're not going to find, in our opinion, humbly speaking, you're not going to find much better institutional macro research content out there.
Okay. Totally get it. And look, as a guy who builds online communities, I know the value that they can be when you aggregate the right people in a place where just the value creation is much greater than just what the host contributes themselves. Sounds like you've created that there. Do me a favor, go back to the website page again for a quick second with the different options again, your four options there.
Yep.
And the question I just want to ask is for the, I don't want to say novice, but for the regular retail investor, maybe consider them on a little bit of the inexperienced side of the scale, which one should they look at potentially first? Like what's the onboarding one for them?
Macro risk manager, for sure. That's the around the horn. That'll give them access to the KISS portfolio construction process. That is for sure. That's the best value for that kind of investor.
Okay.
Say if you're the kind of retail investor that likes monetary plumbing and flows and all that kind of esoteric stuff, then Macro Strategist Pro is for sure the best value for that, because that's where you're going to be able to keep track of all those themes and all the evolution of the signals in real time. But if you're kind of just someone who just needs help, staying on the right side of market risk and help watching your portfolio grow over time, then I would say Macro Risk Manager. So those are probably your two best values.
Okay, great. All right. Well, look, in kind of landing the plane here, there were a couple of things I wanted to get your opinion on before you go. First one is gold.
Yep.
Just thoughts on it. It's had a great run. I can't remember what your position on it or your model's position on it was back at the end of last year. But I'm curious, has its price move surprised you at all? Do you think it's sustainable? I know Bitcoin, well, I know gold isn't in the KISS portfolio, but I'm sure it's something that you guys track as part of your data series, right?
Yeah, 100%. So, going back to this discretionary risk management overlay, we've been dead wrong on gold for the past kind of 4 to 6, really about 4 weeks. The last kind of the second, so there was two explosive moves in gold over the past kind of two and a half months. The first move we were on the right side of because we were in a Goldilocks market regime, and gold is a long in a Goldilocks market regime, and so the model was recommending a max long position in gold. However, over the past kind of month or so, the model's been dead wrong. We've been dead wrong on gold. And really getting squeezed on gold because gold historically has been a short in a reflation market regime. And so right now, because of the gold's neutral VAM signal and the interplay between that and the current regime, the model is recommending discretionary risk management overlay is recommending a short half position. That's obviously been very wrong over the past month or so. And so that's what in my opinion, what's driving the gold price is the rise of geopolitical risk. And we can determine this just by looking at the breakdown in the historical relationship between real interest rates and gold. Right now, we have gold skyrocketing higher while real interest rates are skyrocketing higher and the US dollar is skyrocketing higher. So it's telling you that the thing that gold has historically had the most explanatory power in terms of explaining fluctuations in the gold price is no longer having explanatory power. So it's telling you that something else coming out of left field is driving the price higher, in our opinion. It's the rise of geopolitical risk. It's the breakdown of the situation in the Middle East. Obviously, we could very much get worse, as WHJ was reporting this morning.
Does that make you think then that the spike in gold may be transitory? That if there's a calming down geopolitically, that gold would potentially give up whatever amount of its recent run has been due to the geopolitical issues?
100%. And so that when you go and so we break apart gold's volatility adjusted momentum signal, it's been neutral. Over the past over the last run of this bull leg, which tells you that the volatility of the asset is not confirming the positive price momentum. It's not that the positive price momentum doesn't exist. It obviously exists. We're up at $2,400 in gold. What it's telling you is that the volatility signal is saying you could go up and go back down just as fast. And that's what the neutral volatility adjusted momentum signal is there. So even if we were still in the Goldilocks market regime, which would call for a long position in gold, it would still only be a half long position. Because of that neutral VAM signal. So again, what this table is designed to do is identify what the regime is, and so and tells you it recommends the what the, it tells investors what the proper trade is based on the interplay between that the VAM, the volatile adjusted momentum signal of the asset and the regime. And right now, again, as I mentioned, we've been wrong on gold because over the past kind of 4 weeks or so, because we've been in this reflation regime, and historically gold's been a short in reflation because typically you see a rising real interest rates. And so we would expect, gold is going to have a correction. We expect it will have a correction later this year. It could be very violent, very swift, based on that volatile adjusted momentum signal kind of condition.
Okay. All right. And then just in tying things up in a bow here, last time you were on, you said, essentially, future's so bright, I got to wear shades. Never been, this bullish in my career. Now I think that we're switching into reflation. I hear you say, I'm still bullish, just not as much. Is that capturing the essence, or would you state it differently?
Yeah, no, that's very much that's exactly it. Let me go turn my screen one more time. My apologies. So in terms of what's happened at the margin, let's just talk about this in simple terms. In terms of the themes, what's happened most recently is that we lost a key contributor to the risk-on market regime condition, which is the immaculate quote disinflation theme. I would argue the immaculate disinflation theme is dead. We can unpack the inflation data if you want, but I'm pretty sure everyone's well aware of what happened this week. But it wasn't just the CPI and PPI data this week, which were all well above trend. We look at them from a 3-month annualized perspective. But we also saw this morning today, the University of Michigan inflation surveys cause problems in asset markets today in terms of causing the deeper sell-off for risk assets. In my opinion, I think immaculate disinflation is dead. The only thing that's stopping sticky inflation from causing more problems in asset markets, from a short to medium term perspective, is the fact that both monetary policy from a forward guidance perspective in terms of the rate cuts that are still priced into the futures curve and the net financing policy of the Treasury continues to be quite favorable in terms of Janet Yellen continuing to restrict bond supply as long as the Fed is doing the balance sheet roll-off. Those things are basically, they're like a dam between sticky inflation causing problems and not. And right now, we suspect they will continue to want a soft landing and continue to supply favorable monetary and fiscal policies for the medium term. But ultimately, if sticky inflation really gets out of hand, they're going to have to pivot, and we suspect they will be forced to pivot when we get into Q4. Actually, one slide I'll show you on that. So we don't just piece together the puzzle on things like growth and inflation using qualitative frameworks in terms of, okay, here's a first principle of that. If that's doing this, and this should do that. We also have sophisticated econometric models that project the trend of growth and inflation. And what we see on inflation, we could have some downdrift on inflation over the next 1 to 2 quarters, but we're probably going to bottom and start to reaccelerate in Q4, and more importantly, bottom and start to reaccelerate at a level that is historically inconsistent with 2% inflation. And so by sometime in Q4, maybe Q1 of next year, we're talking about Fed and Treasury that are being forced by the data to do something very different than what they're currently doing. And so when that process takes place, it's anybody's best guess. But my explanation is that markets will probably start to sniff that out by late Q3 at the latest. And we could probably be transitioning to a risk-off inflation market regime then. But if that could happen sooner, if it happens sooner, we'll know all the reasons why. Because again, it's right there in terms of the evolution of the themes. If you start losing these themes and these themes start getting conviction, then that's when it's time to kind of shrink that fundamentally driven expectation of, okay, I think we can survive into the second half of the year in a risk-on condition. We might have to start to pull that estimation of a real-world phase transition forward.
Okay. Well, whenever we make that next phase transition, there is open invitation, in fact, expectation that you'll raise your hand to say, "Hey, I want to come back on the program and let your audience know about it, Darris." So thank you.
I'll be honest, my friend. I will raise my hand, but it'll be well after our clients had a chance to reposition their portfolios.
Absolutely and totally understandable. Yep. No. But when you feel you can tell the general public, we want you to come here early on in that. All right. It's been fantastic as always, my friend. I've got one last question for you that I'm going to ask in just a second. I want to do a couple of quick housekeeping first. One, folks, if you've enjoyed having Darris on this in this interview today, and how could you have not? Please let them know by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. And just as a reminder, if you are not a DIY investor and would like help in implementing either some of Darris's insights here or just trying to figure out how to navigate the new regime that we're in, highly recommend that you work with a financial advisor to do that. To schedule a free consultation with one of the advisors that Thoughtful Money endorses. These are the folks you see on the channel with me week after week. Just go to thoughtfulmoney.com, fill out the short form there. All right, Darris, so final question for you. So you have spent your career to date working with some of the greatest minds in Wall Street, and that's reflected in both your prodigious expertise, but also in the complexity and efficacy of your modeling here. I'm just curious, can you share one of the most useful I guess just one of the top lessons you've learned from interacting with those great thinkers and great investors that you think a regular investor like the folks watching today's video could benefit from taking away?
100%. I can tell you this right now. It's probably two things. Number one, most important thing, in my opinion, is separating your research from your risk management. How you construct your portfolio, how you get into and out of positions, and why you get into and out of positions should not be a function of what you think is going to happen in the future. What you think is going to happen in the future can instruct how you're thinking broadly about portfolio risk, but ultimately, you need to have systematic and quantitative signaling tools to manage risk in a portfolio. If you're managing risk in a portfolio based on your fundamental views or your gut feeling, good luck with that. You're probably going to struggle as an investor. So that's number one. Separate, keep your risk management and your research separate. They should be two independent processes. And when those two independent processes are lining up to say do one thing, that's when you have a lot of conviction. And when those two independent processes are lining up to say we don't know or do something different, particularly for the risk management side, you need to respect that irrespective of what your fundamental beliefs are. So that's number one. And number two is organizing your bets in your portfolio across different factors and different time horizons. Your whole portfolio doesn't have to reflect one theme. It doesn't have to reflect one time horizon or one set of catalysts or one unique group of catalysts that's going to occur on one particular time horizon. You can construct a portfolio that has orthogonal risks. This is something that should occur over the next 3 to 6 months. This is something that might occur over the next 6 to 12 months. This is something that's a 2 or 3 year position. And so have keeping those risks separate allows you to build more defensible, more robust, more diversified portfolio. So those are the two things, organizing your risks across time horizons and factors, and then separately keeping your risk research and your risk management separate. And that's what we do here at 42 Macro. We do all that heavy lifting for them. It's very hard to do this stuff, by the way. It's not easy. It's taken me 15 years of learning and flying around Global Wall Street and meeting with some of the top investors in the world to get our process to this point. And I would say that, we are not perfect by any means, by any stretch of the imagination. We've had a phenomenal run over the past few years. We call it 2022 right on the bear side. We call it 2023 right on the bull side. We obviously been very bullish throughout 2024 here as well. Just because we've had a good run and our process is good doesn't mean I myself don't continue to learn. We don't continue to refine our products, because we do. We continue to refine all of our models and our products, and our clients have benefited from that.
Thank you so much. I think those are two timeless, very important bits of wisdom. And to your point, I would say they're hard to do, and I would say they're even harder to do well, right? And so, kudos to you again for your track record. But again, I think we both feel this way. For the vast majority of people that have a real life, they're working hard to build their wealth, but they don't have the benefit of your, career experience in learning how to do this, and all the years of both advice from great mentors and school of hard knocks and all that stuff, right? That most people should consider, rather than focusing on trying to call the plays themselves, they should be trying to find a good quarterback for them. And so their efforts should be trying on finding the best quarterback. And you offer a great service at your site. I tell people in general, I don't care who you work with, financial advisor related or service like yours, I just want them to find a good one, and hopefully one that performs well over time, but also treats them well and has great customer service and all that type of stuff. So, anyways, you're nodding as I'm saying all this stuff, but like it take there's a lot you got to do what you're saying, but then to actually do it well, you're really beginning to narrow down the universe of people that do that. So spend your time trying to find that good financial quarterback. All right, Darius, look, my friend, we didn't talk at all about your son who's on the way, and I think
Oh,
you
thank
mentioned
you.
that publicly last time we talked here. So I don't think if I'm letting the cat out of the bag, let me know. We'll edit it out, but I think it's public knowledge. But all the best to you and your wife. You've got the greatest investment of all coming into your life in just a couple of months here. Congratulations in advance of that. And the next time I talk to you, I hope you're a very proud papa.
Yeah, thank you very much, brother. I appreciate you, Adam, and very proud of you, man. You've been doing a fantastic service for the global investor community. I think what you're doing here at Thoughtful Money is fantastic, man. So keep up the great work. You got, I can just tell by your viewership and your engagement that you really, really, truly helping a lot of people. Because right, I think there are sort of two avenues of finance. And you and I were talking about this at the beginning of the before we were prepping prior to the show, which is, there's the kind of entertainment finance, which is, crisis is coming, collapse is coming, crisis this, destruction, destroy that. And then there's the, I want to help my clients retire sooner and more comfortably. And we are squarely, 42 Macro is very squarely in the second of those categories. We're not here to make splashy headlines. In fact, our research process is, well, we one of the best compliments I've ever gotten in my career. Last week, a client said, your process is almost boring, but we love it because it's boring. And if you're doing it right, it should be boring. There should be no emotion involved in investing. And if you have too much emotion involved, it's because you're probably a victim of error.
Well, look, thank you for the kind words, and it's right back at you. And I know in past videos we've sort of talked about both our missions to be democratizing financial literacy, financial opportunity. I know that's super near and dear to really both of our hearts. So I do see you as a kindred spirit there, my friend. And look forward to having you back on this channel as soon as possible. And anything we can do in the interim to lend wind to the sales of 42 Macro, just let us know. I know a lot of the viewers feel the same way.
Thanks, brother. And God bless you. God bless the Taggart family. God bless everyone watching. We'll catch you back here next time. Cheers.
All right. See you soon. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.